This is Jeff J. Brown, China Rising Radio Sinoland, and I am very excited to go across the channel from Normandy, France, into Britain. And I have on the show today Ian Hudson. How are you doing, Ian?
I'm good, Jeff. Thank you very much for having me. Great, great to see you. Great to be here.
This is a wild story. Back in about 2019, I think it was, I reached out to Gavin Menzies at the 1421 Foundation because I really wanted to interview him because his books practically changed my life. And then I saw on all, you know, in popular press that he had passed away in 2020. And I said, well, that's, I guess I, you know, I should have contacted him sooner. And then about a couple of months ago, Ian, who is president of the 1421 Foundation, reached out to me by email, and we finally got together. So thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me. Sorry it's taken so long for me to get my act.
So you're a busy man. Ian is president of the 1421 Foundation. He's a scholar and best-selling author who is focused on ancient seafaring civilizations and global maritime exploration. He has worked with Gavin Menzies since 2002 on book projects, as well as a 1421 exhibition in Singapore. Sorry, I missed that. And a TV documentary series before co-authoring Who Discovered America? The Untold History of the Peopling of the Americas. He wrote that with Menzies in 2013. He is a fellow, get a load of this, he's a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society, which has a very rich and deep history going back at least to the 19th century and I think earlier. Was an associate member of the China Maritime Center at the Greenwich Maritime Institute in London, a next generation ambassador for the Committee of 100, and has lectured on his research at prestigious institutions in the UK, such as the University of Oxford and the London School of Economics and Political Sciences, and at Yunnan University in China. That's probably in Dalian. I'm not Dalian, but I'm having a brain burp. What's the capital of Yunnan? I'm having a brain burp. And in Duke University, USA. So this guy knows what he's talking about. Ian, let me just ask you, some people, I mean, it's hard for me to believe that some people would not know, you know, who Gavin Menzies is. But just in case, for the fans out there who may not know the background, please give us a brief account of the great researcher and explorer Gavin Menzies.
Okay, so Gavin, very old, dear family friend of ours. He joined the Navy when he basically went straight out of school when he was 16 and joined the Navy. Had a career in the Navy for about 18 years and ended up in command of a nuclear submarine. So he had a distinguished career. Was you know, highly intelligent man. If you're put in command of a nuclear submarine, you're not some crackpot, which a lot of people say he is, because he came up with this historical theory that I'm going to tell you all about. It's important to know, you know, he had a great career in the Navy. He left the Navy. He had a career as an entrepreneur, working in many different sectors. And then in 2001, I believe, he decided to start writing this book, and he'd had it in his mind for many years, and he'd carried out with his wife over his career in the Navy specifically, and then when he lived in the Middle East, they'd been to so many museums and exhibitions and institutes around the world. They'd started laying the seed for this book, and his book was all about, he was fascinated by the Middle Ages and wanted to see, comparing what was going on around the world in the Middle Ages. And there was a chapter on England, there was a chapter on France, there was a chapter on Egypt, there was a chapter on what was happening in South America. And basically, he'd come up with he admitted it was a very dry book. And he wanted to popularize history. That was always the thing. He wanted to be a popularizer of history. And this book that he created was a huge draft, quite lengthy, quite dry. And him and his wife went off on their 25th wedding anniversary to Beijing, and were giving a tour of the Forbidden City, and this was kind of a slightly new. Apologies if my dog's going to start making strange noises next door to me.
All right.
He was fascinated by the Forbidden City, you know, the huge scale of it and the sophistication of it, and was talking to the guide about, you know, when the Forbidden City was inaugurated, and it turns out it was inaugurated in 1421. Turns out also that the Emperor Zhu Di at the time was sponsoring this series of huge, kind of grandiose to a certain extent, voyages of exploration. They started in 1405, and the main protagonist for the story is Admiral Zheng He, who was a Muslim who was captured by the Chinese army when he was 8 years old, and taken into court, into the imperial court, and castrated and served as a eunuch to the emperor. And he gradually won the trust of the emperor, and the emperor, as a result, put Zheng He in charge of this huge fleet of, I think, well, there were some up to 600 ships, up to 28,000 people crewing those ships. There's a vast kind of floating city. You know, it's a floating city. It was a floating university. It was just had a floating market. It had everything you could name. They had horse ships. They had grain ships. They had water ships, so they could sail the oceans of the earth for, you know, for months and months without having to stop at land. So anyway, Gavin came back from his trip to China, slightly reevaluated his book, and realized that, you know, there was an incredible story to be told about what was going on in China, and not least the comparisons between what was happening in China and England, for example. The level of sophistication. China had been tracking the night skies for thousands of years. They'd invented gunpowder, they'd invented the compass, they'd invented printing, they'd invented all of these fantastic things. I'll talk a bit about that later, because that's what we talk about in the second book. And there's a huge disparity between China at the time and England and France and all the other countries. China was just, you know, it's a colossus. And so Gavin, yeah, started writing a bit more about China. Then I'm sorry if I'm slightly waffling, but he sent this document about, you know, what was going on in the world in the Middle Ages, and he sent it to about 100 experts for checking. And one of these experts was a curator of a library in Minnesota, the James Ford Bell Library, University of Minnesota. She asked him if he knew about this map. It was called the Pitsigano map, and it was dated 1424, and it showed Europe with quite good, fairly accurate. But it had, going out into the Atlantic, it had these strange islands that were plotted out on the far side of the Atlantic. And Gavin, having been to those islands on in the Navy on a boat, he could immediately see, you know, in his opinion, that those islands were Puerto Rico, or part of Puerto Rico, part of the Caribbean. And the next question was, if that was the Caribbean drawn in 1424, how could it have been? Who could have drawn it? Like, how can you know, we're told at school that Columbus discovered the Americas in 1492. How can you discover a place for which you already have a map? And his research continued, and he found basically that the whole world had been mapped by before the European voyages of discovery had started. So before Cabral and Diaz in the 1480s, before Columbus, before Magellan, before Vasco da Gama, before all these European greats, so, you know, we talk about in schools around the world as these fantastic explorers. And it was obvious that somebody else had got around the world and charted it before these guys. And they to do it, they'd had to have had a significant capacity of, not only did they have to have a good quality of a good number of boats, but they would have had to have a good quality of crew as well to actually be able to chart so accurately using latitude and longitude. So yeah, he was slightly gobsmacked, and he decided to reevaluate his theory, and started looking. I'm trying to think of the timeline, but I started working for him in 2002, and my first job for him was to translate some of the early, I studied Spanish and Portuguese, so I was translating some of the early Spanish and Portuguese maps and the first accounts of the Spanish explorers who arrived in the Americas and describe in their books seeing visitors who they say were came from China, or they had visitors who had ornately carved boats, and they had gold and silver, and they were wearing silk, and they had, they described them being a sophisticated race that were not the same. They were different in look and in culture to the Native Americans. And so, yeah, there was suddenly this mound of evidence was beginning to grow that yes, there were in fact early Chinese voyages to the Americas. And so then Gavin, he did this big talk at the Royal Geographical Society in 2002. He got a fantastic book deal. He was an unpublished author, and he got this, a very sizey advance for his book from Transworld, who are a global publisher. And they've set a team up who helped him kind of weave turn the book into something a bit more readable, because it was very dry and a bit boring, to be quite honest. So made it a bit more readable. We had a help of, I was helping with various things with the Spanish and Portuguese, and we had all these maps and stuff printed in, and yeah, so lo and behold, 1421 came out in 2002, and was published in the US shortly after. It was a different title. It's called Who Discovered It, 1421, who the year China discovered America. And then it's got to number three in the New York Times bestsellers chart. It translated into, I believe, 29 languages. And we set up this website,
Wow.
with this website, gavinmenzies.net, which basically we were kind of, it wasn't before the internet kicked off. It was about 6 or 7 years after the internet, as we know, it started really making waves. But Gavin, and I always slightly joke that he was in charge of a nuclear submarine and had his finger on the red button, but he didn't know how to type. So I was always the one who was helping him with emails, and I helped create the website, and we used the website to act as a kind of nexus point for researchers who, I guess, the problem is it's such a controversial theory that anybody could have discovered the Americas before Columbus. It's so controversial that there's always a huge amount of controversy, and there's always a huge amount of criticism. But we were trying to create a community with this website, of community of people who believed in what we said and believed that, there was, they're often referred to as fringe historians or armchair historians, citizen scientists. I heard that one the other day, which I quite like. And yeah, we were trying to, build up a community of those kind of people who agreed with us, and who had, that they saw that it made sense, but also they had carried out their own research. And we were inundated over the years, and inundated to the point that we, wrote four books total. After the first book, we wrote three more books. So we were inundated with people saying, "Did you know about this? Did you know about this theory? Did you know about this book that was written in 1730 that told of the Chinese visiting Mexico? Did you know about these ancient carvings in Australia that were clearly of Aboriginal carvings that show four or five masted ships, but they're dated to pre-Europeans? All these like strange linguistic similarities, cultural similarities, different types of art. You see the motif of the dragons, throughout Asia, and then in Central and South America. It's just a huge like panoply of evidence slash data. We shouldn't call it evidence, because some of it we had to corroborate. I mean, we had to try and pick through it and work out what we thought was, was correct. And so that book came out in 2002. It did remarkably well. We set up a research team in London. Gavin was constantly away giving lectures. So I was kind of building this team in London. And then, yeah, we wrote three more books, which I can talk about in due course. And he very sadly got Alzheimer's
Oh.
in 2018 and Parkinson's, and he passed away 2 years later.
Yeah.
So that was, it was very sad. But he, but as sorry, but yeah. So, as a res, not a result of that, but what I always did was, I was very keen. Like Gavin was very thick-skinned, So any criticism that he would just shake it off. He's like, look, I can't possibly read every single email that gets, or every article that's written about me. I can't read the thousands of reviews on Amazon. There's not enough time in the world. So I've just got to, concentrate on what I'm trying to do and keep going. But I was of a slightly different, I just wanted to try and secure some more academic backing for us because I thought it was really important. There were some really vicious academics out there who hated us, and they'd spent all their lives saying that Columbus discovered America 1492. So they were slightly put out of place by us saying that we think the Chinese got there before them. So I was trying to gain academic support, and in order to do that, we got a really good kind of supporting committee. I've got letters of recommendation from all sorts of people around the world, who believe what we're trying to do. But I set up the 1421 Foundation as a kind of an entity in order to run everything. Previously, it had all been run from the basement in Gavin's house. They got a very nice house in London, but it was in the basement. So I was like, let's set up the 1421 Foundation. It's a US-based 501c3. So we have been in the past, we've been receiving donations to it, and I'm actively trying to receive donations for it because we need to keep it going to perpetuate what we're doing. Sorry, and I should say to your listeners that the website is 1421foundation.org. I'm sure we can probably mention that again towards the end of this interview. But we have various projects, and my goal that from a not even a selfish point of view, but something that I've been trying to do for the last probably 15 years is prove unequivocally that the 1421 theory slash hypothesis is solid, and that yes, there were various ocean-going civilizations that crossed the oceans and arrived in the Americas before the European voyages of discovery. Some of them, our latest book, Who Discovered America, we debate whether or not actually the Beringia theory of migration, that people came across the Bering Land Bridge 15,000 years ago, we say actually they were far more likely to have come by boat because it was quicker and it was more efficient, and they had access to seaweed, and they had access to kelp, and they had access to mammals and fish to eat. So it was the Beringia theory is potentially outdated, and I think new evidence has proved that anyway. But yeah, my goal was just to prove that yeah that the some of these critics can yeah they can do one, because actually we have proof now. There's unequivocal proof that man sailed the oceans and got to the Americas, got to Australia, New Zealand, in boats before the European voyages. So I'm not denigrating, the people who arrived in the Australasia, and how they got there, nor the Beringia theory. But I'm saying that man has been a lot more sophisticated, making use of the winds and the currents, for thousands of years, before the European voyage of discovery, before this kind of Eurocentric, the Eurocentric paradigm that Columbus and Christianity were the people who spread the word and who discovered and opened up the world. That's rubbish, quite frankly. So that is what I'm trying to prove.
Well, you don't, I'll tell you what, Ian, by the way, you'll be pleased to know I still have my copy of 1421.
Excellent.
I have the 2008 edition, and I think a lot of stuff was added to the
Yeah.
to the 2000, a lot of extras, because you said they were, finding more
Yeah,
and more stuff.
we kept on editing and updating, amending.
So there it is, fans. It's
There it is, fans.
and by the way, Ian mentioned I will have their website. I will have the book website. I'll have Amazon. I have their Facebook. I have their email. So you can contact them after the show, and if you'd like to find out more. And I actually had 1434. Was it four? No, 1424, right?
No,
Which one?
1434.
Well, yeah,
1434. Yeah.
1434. And I loaned it to somebody, and the clown never gave it back to me.
Oh
So,
dear, that's a shame.
but
We'll have to get you another copy. Would
no.
you like to talk about that? 1434, or I can't remember what
Well,
your questions.
I can tell you folks that if you read 1434 is a little bit more speculative, but 1421, if you really have to be wearing blinders, you really have to have, telescopic vision to not see that all this, it's just the evidence is just piled so high. And it's just so obvious, that the Chinese, made it to the what we call the New World before the Europeans got there. And of course, Westerners are upset, about what, Gavin and now Ian are doing, because it completely, upends, world history. I mean, it just like blow it's like it blows it out of the water. And so obviously it really upsets people, and then people are proud, and let's face it, racist, and people just, they don't want to admit that, that the Chinese, beat us to it, so to speak. And yeah, just tell us quickly about the two, and as far as I'm concerned, they're not even theories. To me, it's just the 1434 is a little bit more
So,
speculative, but tell us about
yeah.
1421, that which for me is a slam dunk, and then tell us about 1434.
Okay, well, I mean, 1421, I've kind of talked about, but the basics are the world history. Sorry, what the world history that is generally taught at schools. A, it says that Columbus discovered the Americas, or the European voyages of discovery opened up the world to trade. But B, they do talk about Zheng He in some in China for sure, and in Southeast Asia, India, they talk about Zheng He because he was a very famous explorer. But nobody in the UK or the US had really heard of him. I don't think I hadn't for sure. So 1421, it starts on this, the question of how do you discover a place for which you already have a map. It talks about China and how advanced she was. And compared especially to other nations like England at the time. And then it talks about Zheng He and his life. And what's accepted in world history is that Zheng He had these seven voyages, but we're told that he went to, he went to, for example, to Malacca in Malaysia. He went around Southeast Asia and he went around the Indian Ocean. We know he got as far as Africa, or we're told he got as far as Africa because we can see in, this book called the Illustrated Book of Strange Countries. It shows he brought back pictures of he sorry he even brought back giraffes for the emperor. He brought back animals from Africa for the emperor's zoo, and he brought back rhino, and he brought back giraffes and zebra, and we can see them in these pictures. But it also these pictures also show some other weird and wonderful creatures that aren't, for example, unique that could have come from South America. There's one particular story where Gavin talks about this large giant ground sloth called a Mylodon that was around extinct now. I think Darwin found a cop found one, a corpse in a cave site in South America. And there are all these weird and wonderful creatures that are described, and also places that are shown on maps that weren't described until the Europeans got there. We know Vancouver Island, for example, which Vancouver discovered in, God, I'm not sure, 17 something, was described in an Italian map of 100 years before that as a Chinese colony. We kind of just delved into all of these amazing stories. There's just incidences all over of strange animals cropping up, of plants that, we know that the Chinese, the junks at the time had. They carried bananas and rice and coconut. They carried all these amazing plants and vegetables to stop scurvy, and so they could live abroad for many, many, many years at a time. And types of pig, for example, pigs were kept in sties and dogs and all, you know, all these animals that suddenly that and I call them, it's like anomalous archaeology. These animals crop up either in ancient maps or ancient drawings or ancient graves, and they're just completely anomalous to where they should be. Like the turkey was is a type of Central American pheasant, and that was on dining tables in Europe before, you know, 50 years before Columbus supposedly brought it back from America. And it's the same with, we had this really interesting Chinese herbology showing all these amazing spices that they used in their cooking and in their medicine. And you know, why is there a pepper there? Pepper's supposedly introduced from the Americas after the 1492 voyage of discovery. How's the tomato? How did it get to China before the Europeans introduced it to them? And it's just there's nonsense. There's so many of these incidences. And then we set up the website and we got really into the granularity of it. And there's, for me, like the most important thing that a lot of the experts just kind of ignore is the DNA evidence, where recent DNA studies have shown that some Native American peoples, and they tend to be the ones that are sea by the co coastal sites or by big rivers, they have like high statistically significant levels of East Asian admixture that comes from recent gene flow, and it's not from the Bering Straits. It's described as recent gene flow, which is not 15,000 years ago. How do they get that admixture? And the, you know, the analysis now can show that it came when it came. There's like a genetic footprint. There's number of diseases and parasites, for example, that are unique to Southeast Asia that are found in communities in the Amazon. For example, they're found in this is I'm just dusting off my memory banks here, but there was a type of hookworm, I think it's called Ancylostoma duostema, which is found in a foss not fossilized, in the remains of a body from about, I think, 1,000 years ago, that had been preserved. And it's unique to Southeast Asia. And this was found like in the Amazon or something. It's like how does this stuff happen if people hadn't been there to visit beforehand? And we always said that unlike the Europeans, the Chinese, Zheng He specifically, was a very he was an ambassador for peace. And I know that we always compare them to kind of eco-tourism of today, where you say you take only photos, leave only footprints and take only photos. And that's pretty much what they did. But there is evidence around the world of these little, not only from the DNA, but of these little communities of Chinese people that were there before the European voyage of discovery. So there's a little almost a colony in California that was described as speaking Chinese. And this is before, you know, the gold rush and all that. It was very early arrivals to the Americas before 1492. Speaking Chinese, understanding Chinese, having similar cultural and customs and values, producing similar artwork, and you know, all this stuff. One really cool story that I heard about quite recently was a and I'm very I'm in such a fortunate position. I get sent emails every day of like the most amazing stuff. It's just really fascinating that people have been carrying out their own research, or they have family. You know, we'll talk about Charlotte Rees in a bit, who's I think she found her grandfather's maps in the attic of her house, or something similar. But people just writing in, they've seen Gavin, who was on the TV a lot, who's on the radio a lot when he's doing his book tours, and they wanted to share their evidence that they'd found. One thing that I got into recently, I went to go meet this guy who's based in Newfoundland, and he's a Beothuk, which is the Native American people of Newfoundland. Newfoundland's incredible. I don't know if you've been there, but
Yeah, I have.
it's
I
vast,
actually have.
very
It's
very
huge. It
beautiful,
used to be a
huge,
country. It used to be a
huge.
country.
Yeah,
You had
and
its own
yeah,
stamps and everything.
and. Yeah, the very friendly people, and had a fantastic trip there. But I went to meet this academic who's a researcher, and he is very intelligent man. And he was telling me that he's a Beothuk. His family history, his oral history, goes back 800 years, I think. It's been carried through the centuries by folklore, through song, and through stories. that his grandmother told him and her grandmother told her, and da da da, goes back hundreds of years. And he was doing some research in Newfoundland. He was hearing about this shipwreck from, we you know, read about it in the, or you know, the oral stories about this shipwreck that was there 600 years ago before the Europeans arrived. It was this huge wooden shipwreck, and they all talked about how they would see people on this wreck, and they left them alone because they didn't want to go and disturb them, but it was a huge wooden wreck. And then gradually the songs talked about how the wreck began to disappear under the water, and they could still see the masts. And gradually the wreck was no more. He was intrigued. He married a Chinese lady, and didn't really, I don't think he didn't hear about 1421 or anything like that, but he went to China and went to the National Museum of China in Beijing, and was at the kind of folklore culture section. I can't remember which particular province it was from, but there was this exhibit, and it showed all these totems and symbols and types of coinage. And he said he had this kind of epiphany. He kind of couldn't talk, and couldn't. He was just His mind was completely blown, because all of these things he had seen in his museum in Newfoundland. He had exactly the same totems and artwork and symbols, and he was just blown away. He's like, wow, does this mean that there was a visit from China to Newfoundland however long ago? And that would explain the wreck, and that would explain some other wrecks in the area that he knows about. So he's got on this mission. I went to go meet him, and he's on a mission to prove, that his ancestors would have met these Chinese people 600 years ago. And yeah, he's seen as a, lots of people in Newfoundland don't believe, and they don't want to believe that story, because there's a much more easier to believe story that, Newfoundland was, the Beothuks were there, and then they got, sadly decimated. So yeah, so it's always quite political wherever there's a story. Like New Zealand, we have, in 1421 we talk about the fleets going to New Zealand and going to Australia before the Europeans. And there was research that was carried out there in kind of 2005 to 2010, I guess, by a surveyor called Cedric Bell, who went carried out some incredible research. And he believes that he found remnants of huge Chinese fortifications, barracks, mining activity, all sorts of stuff. And we had some of the stuff carbon dated, which was great, and it proved that, yeah, there was some wood here that was chopped down in the 1400s. But he met huge resistance, because the Maori have, all these land rights over mineral rights, the land rights. They don't want to have to suddenly give up any of that, because there's going to be a Chinese claim saying that they arrived there before them. Same with Australia. It's very it's just everywhere we go, there are doors are slammed in our faces. Or sorry, I'd say doors were slammed in our faces. But now, 20 years later, what is it, 2024? It's and sorry, going back to the 1421 Foundation. Yeah, I wanted the foundation to be able to apply scientific rigor to our investigations, so it would be a way of shutting down the academics who were, saying that we were hobbyists or whatever. I wanted to do everything professionally and do it under the guise of, of professional archaeologists. So that was to give me and the 1421 Foundation the credibility that I wanted. So sorry, going back to 1421. So yeah, it talks about these voyages of discovery, the continents that they explored, the maps that show how they got there, the Chinese maps, the European maps, and then the evidence, findings of jade and ceramics down the Amazon and rice plantations, bananas, all that kind of stuff. And then it goes into technical analysis on kind of astro navigation and how the Chinese could have calculated longitude and latitude. And to be quite honest, I haven't read it for 15 years. I can't remember how it ends, but I would say that since that book was published, we then, we set up the website, and we had all these people writing in to us. And one of the questions was, why wouldn't the Chinese have visited Europe? And we didn't really have an answer to that. But then this Chinese scholar got in touch with us and said, yeah, proof that they visited Europe because there's an account, this Florentine polymath called Paolo Toscanelli, who was one of the Pope's advisors. He was also Columbus's mentor, and he is famous for writing a letter to Columbus that said, "Dear Christopher Columbus, I'm paraphrasing here. I had a meeting. A delegation came to me, came from China to meet in the court with the Pope and myself. They were, he calls them, men of great learning and great sophistication of culture and civilization." He says they taught him all about geography, about how the world was a sphere, how you could sail, you'd set sail in one direction, you could come back to the same place if he managed it properly. You go around the world. And he said that they were hugely knowledgeable in mathematics and cartography and geography and science. He was the one who showed Christopher Columbus a globe. He said in another of his letters, he says, "This is a globe that I got from this, I was given by this delegation who came from China." And another kind of, sorry, 1434 was a result of the question, did they go to Europe? And then we carried out some research and we found out, yeah, we believe they did go to Europe because A, this guy Toscanelli said there was a delegation. We, you know, it could have been five people delegation. I don't suppose it was a huge fleet that sailed to Europe, but I'm saying there were visitors there. There'd been visitors coming from China for hundreds of years beforehand. But this was specifically in Zheng He's era, and we know that shortly after, in Italy, the Renaissance kind of erupted, and we know that Da Vinci, for example, we know that Da Vinci, so he was great, fantastic drawer, draftsman, but he didn't really invent stuff. He kind of worked on other people's pieces. He invented some stuff, but he didn't. He's credited for inventing like the helicopter, the machine gun, the suspension bridge, canals and locks, and all these remarkable things. But actually, the Chinese had been doing it for hundreds, if not thousands, of years beforehand, of which there is evidence because I went to Hong Kong and I went to look in these amazing Chinese in encyclopedias where you can see pictures of armaments and you can see pictures of they don't actually, there isn't a picture of a helicopter, but they did, they knew about the physics of rotary motion, but you know, for centuries, and they've been using it in children's toys, for example. They had mini helicopters, those are the ones you got like that. And yeah, the theory was basically, did, if the Chinese came to Europe to meet, have an audience with the Pope, did they hand over information? If so, what information would it have been? How would they have handed it over? And our answers to that were, we thought there was huge amount of information because suddenly there was the introduction of gunpowder into Europe. There was the introduction of the printing press. There was the introduction of canals and locks in Italy specifically. So Italy had introduction of mulberry trees, which then meant creation of silk, which then meant the silk could be transported to Venice and traded around the world. So there was, yeah, the Industrial Revolution in Italy, we say, was potentially sparked by this delegation who provided all this information. The information was provided, they had printed books and they had scrolls and they had encyclopedia they could have handed over had they wanted to, that could have, you know, they could have shared all this information, they could have shared maps, they could have shared, and part of the Chinese delegation's mission was to impress other countries and bring them back to China to show, bring them into China's trading system and impress on China how great, sorry, impress on the rest of the world how great China was. So this could have been a way to do it. That was the second book. It came out 2008, I think. I can't remember. And then we wrote a third book, which was called The Lost Empire of Atlantis, which was a slightly change of tack, but it was, Gavin went on holiday to Crete, and was learning about the Minoan civilization, who have a, you know, their outpost in Crete, which is incredible. The palaces there, the huge monuments and buildings in Crete, which were mostly destroyed in 1500 BC by this, the eruption of Santorini, this volcanic island, Thera, which erupted in 1500 BC and destroyed like this whole civilization in the Mediterranean and wiped out, you know, coastal Mediterranean and Egypt, parts of Egypt. It was like this phenomenal cataclysmic event. And they started excavating under through the ash in Santorini and found these amazing frescoes, which Gavin went to go and see when he was there. And these frescoes show these huge, probably up to 70 meters long ships, wooden ships with sails, with rudders, with multiple oars. And Gavin suddenly was like, "Oh, maybe they were ocean-going ships. Maybe they had that capacity." Because at the time, this is 3,000 years ago, so throughout 3,000 BC, I should say, the Egyptians weren't known as great seafarers. They didn't have the right trees to for building ocean, building long, large vessels. But yeah, the Minoans were a sophisticated seagoing civilization, and there was a shipwreck in off the coast of Turkey in Bodrum. So in the Museum of Bodrum now, called the I forget its name. I forget its name. I'm sorry. And the Uluburun wreck, which had it sunk about 1500 BC. It was a bit like a kind of time capsule, I guess, like all shipwrecks are, but it was very well preserved. And it had hippopotamus teeth, it had elephant tusks, it had ostrich eggs, it had amber from the Baltic, it had all of these trade goods that it had been carrying on it when it sunk in the Mediterranean. And that gave you a kind of snapshot of where they'd been traveling. But the real controversy was whether or not these Minoans could have A got all the way up to England, for example. Did they get up to England, the coast of England, this Spain, France, Portugal, England, Scotland, whether they got that far, and then whether or not, if they did, would they have crossed the Atlantic? Why would they have done it? There was copper that was found in the Uluburun wreck, and they're called I think they're copper ingots or oxide. They're strange shaped copper, and the copper was analyzed by some scientists, and it was found to be 99.9% pure, like very, very high purity copper. And when they compared this to other copper around the world, the only copper of such purity was the copper found in the Great Lakes. So the Great Lakes, US, Canada, they were known to have been mined thousands of years ago. A huge amount of copper was mined from them, but a lot of the natives didn't ever admit that they had mined that copper. They were mostly using the surface copper for their jewelry and ornaments. But there was a huge amount of like proper industrial sized mines being dug thousands of years ago. And the connection was whether or not the Minoans could have crossed. They were very good at navigating it, crossing large bodies of water. Could they cross the Atlantic and got to the Great Lakes and mined all this copper and brought it back? And then it was just at that time of civilization when the Bronze Age began. So copper and tin that we know is mined in Cornwall. Yeah, it was kind of joint connecting all the dots. And there was, I think this, for me, what was really interesting was I think Gavin was very visual. Some of the evidence that he pulled together, and we did it in our next bit, Who Discovered America, which I'll tell you about now. But it was like the visual elements of comparing a piece of art or an instrument or an ornament or something from one side of the Atlantic with the other, and finding these samples that were exactly the same in function and form, but there was like how did one civilization create these coins that were made, very strange shapes, and then another civilization on the other side of the Atlantic do exactly the same thing at exactly the same time? Was there some kind of diffusionism? Had people been across and shared their ideas? And that was the kind of ethos behind it. And there's a range of different kind of threads for that particular book, but I think it wasn't received very well because it had Atlantis in the title, and people, especially kind of academics, when they see Atlantis, they'll just poo-poo, look down their nose and turn the next book to the next book. So that book didn't do especially well, and it wasn't promoted very well, I don't think. And then finally, we did Who Discovered America, which was kind of effectively a com not a compilation, but Yeah, I mean, almost a compilation of all the stuff that we'd received in the 15 years since the first book came out. So we plowed through all of this data that we're still receiving this evidence today, but we
It's
drew a line and said,
unbelievable.
we said, look, this is clearly the Beringia theory is clearly very outdated, because we know that, the ice-free corridor they talk about all these things to try and make the Beringia theory sound more believable, and it's just poppycock. Why would you want to go and like travel across this barren, cold, inhospitable land? It was tundra. There weren't any, you couldn't like find a tree, chop it down and build a fire, because there weren't any trees. You couldn't like melt snow for drinking water because you couldn't have a fire, which just wasn't a very fun place to be. And we know some people were there and they survived and they did things, but we think it would be much easier to build a boat, however rudimentary it might be, and just sail in the currents and sail island hopping, going down the coast, kelp forests, seals, and whales, and all sorts of big mammals to feast on. Just a much easier way of doing it. And we're told at schools that the first man came, first human remains were found in a place called Clovis, New Mexico. So the Clovis theory is that man came across the Bering Straits and got their way all the way down to New Mexico, and that's the first instance of, I think, the earliest remains of a human found in the New World. But recently, and it's way before, it's in the 70s, 80s, so before our books, they started finding these, there was evidence actually of early human habitation in South America for sure. In Brazil, a place called Pedra Ferrada, there's cave paintings, rock art, there's evidence of fires, human fires dating back 50,000 years.
Wow.
In a place called, I forget the name now, in Chile, where there's another excavation dating 30,000 years or so. So predating the Clovis theory by 15,000 years, which is incredible. But
Yeah, it
they were
is.
always, these guys came up with so much against so much criticism and controversy that they were often silenced. And so we had our shot at it, and we put together the DNA evidence, we put together all the incredible stories, with Charlotte Rees's maps, and other people who we've been engaging with, who had found Chinese maps, or they'd found Chinese research, Chinese accounts saying that people had got to the Americas for thousands of years before the Europeans. So we collated that all into one book called Who Discovered America? And I think that's been translated into three languages. And we haven't done anything since then, because I got involved with the 1421 Foundation. Gavin became ill, unfortunately. And so we've now got to a stage where I'm running the 1421 Foundation. We have various projects that are really exciting that I can talk to you about. And we're looking to raise some funding in order to carry out these projects. I'm pretty sure if the ones that I'm confident are, if we can get them off the ground, they're literally going to be rewriting the history of the world. So, very exciting, everything to play for. I just need to help. I need help getting more visibility for the foundation, which doing this interview will surely do. So thank you very much for that. And I'm meeting with lots of interesting people around the world who are all, excited. They all, a lot of them are very passionate about Zheng He. I'm meeting with the people in Malaysia at the moment who are putting on some conferences, who are, Zheng He, they have a very fond place for Zheng He in Malaysia, because he visited there multiple occasions, and there are shrines and there are temples, and there's a museum there which I helped curate.
And he was Muslim.
And he was Muslim, exactly. So
Yeah,
the Malaysians are very keen with doing some stuff with them. Yeah, there's lots going on. There's a really cool find that I was involved with. I've heard about it for about 5 years. There were some Australian metal detectorists in a place called Shark Bay in Western Australia, and they were on the news quite recently. They flew. They were doing some metal detecting, very isolated part of the world. No one had been there for years. No one had done any type of excavation, and they came across and they documented it, this bronze figurine of a Buddha. And it's
Of a
like
Buddha.
a Buddha, yeah, it's a baby Buddha. And it's unique, and it was gilt. And it was they took it to the University of Western Australia, and the guy who saw it would like kind of laughed at them and said, you know, whatever, you're crackpots. He then analyzed it, and his analysis on the corrosion showed that it had been in situ for at least, I think, 150 to 200 years. So a long time it had been in situ. But that doesn't prove that it was there. You know, it could have been dropped by someone 200 years ago. It doesn't prove that it came with the Chinese fleet. However, anyway, they did all this research. They flew the Buddha to England to go on this TV show called Antiques Roadshow, which you and your viewers may have
Yeah,
heard of,
I've heard about it.
where people bring they bring stuff they found to these experts. And this expert said, yeah, it's from the Ming Dynasty. It's an imperial treasure. It's a unique world treasure. You have to cherish it and, you know, protect it at all costs. They got in touch with me because we were trying to build a bit of publicity on that story, whether or not it could have come from a Chinese fleet. And the reason why I got so excited about it was because I'd been contacted separately by someone who had been diving. They'd known about this wreck for years. It's in Shark Bay as well, and note of warning, you don't really want to go diving in Shark Bay because of the name.
It lives up to its reputation,
It definitely lives up to its
huh?
reputation. Anyway, this guy, he contacted me. He'd sent his these images on Google. You can see them on Google Earth. They're incredible. They'd show this like very long, wide wreck. It's in about 5 to 10 meters of water, but it's covered in coral and sand now because it's old. And basically, yeah, it's like 100 meters long. No, nobody else apart from the Chinese would have built a wooden junk, a wooden vessel of that size. You can see the dimensions and stuff, and it's got, you can see the watertight bulkheads it's got in there.
Like they invented.
He knows it's wooden. He's dived on it. And he got excited about the Buddha find. He's sure there might be other wrecks. He's looking to get funding to do aerial magnetometer, so you fly over the site with one of the planes from the mining. It's quite near mining operations. Fly that over and find out what's there, because it's completely middle of nowhere, isolated, barren space. So if there is a wreck there, or if there's evidence of, you know, a wrecked vessel or fleet, it should show up fairly easily, one would hope. Problem there is, yet again, kind of government, political nervousness about sunny China laying claim to a piece of Australian land because there's a Chinese wreck there that came centuries before the Dutch. And yeah, so that's a bit of a political hot potato. But that to me is like the smoking gun. It's really powerful. Having
Well,
seen
yeah,
the photos.
because the Zheng He, he had the he first off, you mentioned 28,000 people. I want people to think about that number because it is actually the equivalent of half the population of London, England at the time. So it's
Yeah,
like
incredible.
half of London, is on this flotilla. I've heard, 300 and something ships, and
Yeah,
they had
600.
so yeah
Hoxie.
and they had what were called these treasure ships, which
Yeah.
had the loot, that had all the money,
Yeah,
and
money, porcelain.
those were over 100 meters long,
Yeah,
which were
incredible.
over
They're
a
like they were
hundred
the length of
unbelievable.
a submarine that Gavin was controlling, but made of wood, powered by wind.
Or a football
Fascinating.
pitch.
Exactly, yeah. So yeah, it's incredible. And to me, yeah, that is one heck of a story. If we can link the two of those, the Buddha with this huge wreck, and you know, get some boots on the ground and go and dive on this wreck again, see if we can, you know, see what there is to be found. That's just
Is
gonna
is it right
completely
off
blow.
the is it right off the coast, or is it out kilometers out?
It's off the coast, it's close. It's
It's
really
close.
quite, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, I know Gavin had one that he found in San Francisco Harbor.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's a really cool one. We talk about that in 1421. It's a really interesting one. It's a bit sad because I don't think anything's going to happen with it. But basically, there's all these rumors for years. I don't know how, but who came up with the rumor first, or why it kind of surfaced? But of a junk sailing up the Sacramento River, and being grounded up the Sacramento River, and it was a huge ship apparently, and it was before the Europeans, and there was it, unfortunately, it's on. I think it belongs. The land belongs to three landowners, so it's a bit of a in the middle of it all, and they all want different things. But and I should say the wreck is buried quite deep underground,
Yeah, I remember that.
and there's a river flowing over it. But we they sent an archaeological team there. They carried out ground penetrating radar, and they found like the readings show, yeah, there's a mass of something that is underneath the ground. They then they did a core sample drill. So the drill went down and it brought up core that had samples of poppy seeds and rice in it, which is significant.
What
But
a
also,
coincidence.
what a coincidence, but even more coincidental is this type of wood called ketelaria, which is of Asian origin, and they sent the wood off to a lab to get it analyzed. They said, yeah, it's from Asia, and the carbon dating showed it to be from around 1410 AD, which to me is like, what's a slam dunk? But nothing has happened as because it's just so frustrating. Let's get some water. So yeah, there are lots of things like that that are exciting, controversial, frustrating, because we haven't either got the money to do it further, or we come up against a brick wall. And there's some things like we talked about this wreck in what's it called? The Great Dismal Swamp, south of DC. There was this book. George Washington made a lot of his man land money reclaiming land, and part of one of the projects was draining the Great Dismal Swamp, and they cut this channel called the Washington Canal, and when they're cutting that canal, the remains of this Chinese junk rose up out of the waters, is what
Really?
we read it, and that was incredible in itself. And then in 1914, they decided to widen the canal, and the US Army Corps of Engineers had to cut through this junk because it was a wooden wreck in the canal. They had to cut through it because it was in the way of their canal. So they talk about it in their archives. And then apparently there was a very sad a plane crash, a military plane crash that crashed in the swamp. And the search party came across this wreck again in 1918, I think it was. So there were these three instances. But then we got one of our archaeologists, we got him to go and do some desk-based research. We'd been sent all this data. We were really excited about it. He went down to the archives. He went to Virginia. He went to Newport News, I think. And he just couldn't find anything about it. And we just had to go, oh, that's a shame. We'll have to leave that stone, we'll leave that door open, leave it ajar, and hopefully we'll find more data about it another time. But currently we can't find anything more about it, and we're not going to go and do it. So, that's that. So, we are open-minded about our research. If somebody sends us something, we don't, we'll read everything with open arms, with open eyes, but we can't just write it as fact if it's not true.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, I will show this to you all again. If you have not read it, it's an incredible read. And I mean, I just it's like it's I'm not dumb. I'm not stupid. And it's pretty obvious that all the evidence in this is, I mean, to me, it's a slam dunk. Well, tell us about Charlotte Harriet Reese, because you all kind of got me to look into her stuff, and I bought her books and read her books, and you know, she's talking about how the Chinese crossed the Pacific in 2250 BC, and her information is just as bulletproof as yours. Tell us, are you all working together, or?
I heard from her last week. We worked with her for probably about 10 years, I guess. I went to go and visit her. We went for a lovely walk on the Blue Ridge Park, called Blue Ridge Mountains, and
Oh, yeah.
anyway, had a very nice time with her. And she came to England, and we had a presentation at the Royal Geographical Society where she presented some of her work. And yeah, we've known her for years. We haven't really recently. We haven't been in touch a huge amount. I'm not actually sure if she's still kind of actively doing what she was doing, but she had basically amassed a collection of maps from her father, Hendon Harris, who was a missionary who was based out in Asia, I think China and Korea. And he'd come across these maps. He was confident that the maps that he'd found, which are these great circular maps, were maps that tied in with this book called the Shanghai Jing, which was kind of the world's oldest geography, which is a Chinese book that had described all the places in Earth, going back to 2200 BC, I think is the date. And she was confident that these maps, were proof. And how did she think they were proof? She not only did she have them analysed for what they were saying on the maps, but she, you know, that there were they showed places thousands of years before the Europeans got there. So they showed the Grand Canyon in great detail. They showed all these amazing Central American plants like cacti and stuff like that. They showed, I think, armadillos and these weird and wonderful creatures that just
They
didn't
just they
n
described the
no one could have.
Rocky they described the Rocky Mountains, and it's just
And yeah, like
unreal.
how can you draw something on a map if you haven't seen it? You can make it up, but you can't see into the future, and you need to have been there to have done it. Anyway, yeah, so we had a good relationship with Charlotte, but we've not really been in touch a great deal recently. And I'd love to know where her research is leading her. I think her last book was actually a book about her father, because he was, he's this kind of enigmatic man who had some amazing adventures. So I think I don't quite know what path she's going down at the moment. We've made some amazing, been very lucky to have some great friends who, people who, researchers who've become our friends over the years, and they're all over the world. And we have a great community of people who, we have about 8,000 subscribers on our newsletter. So if any of your listeners want to subscribe to the newsletter, they can do so at our website, which is
I'm one of
1421. You're one of them. Good.
them.
I'm sure you'll spread the message, Jeff, far and wide. Because the more people that, whenever I send out a newsletter, I only do it every 3 months now, you get this amazing response. All these people are suddenly like, "Oh yeah, I found some maps in my attic." I had someone yesterday who 30 years ago, he lives in Malibu. He's a surfer, but 30 years ago he used to surf in Baja, California. And very following these amazing waves in very isolated spots, and he found a cache of ceramics, Chinese ceramics, just on this random beach in the middle of nowhere, and didn't really think anything of it. And he found some carved symbols in a rock, I think. He didn't think anything of it. He's just like, "Oh, that's weird." And then 30 years later, he read 1421, and he's now, I think, in his 60s, 70s. He wants to go back there and see if he can find it again. And yeah, I know. I
Amazing.
heard he sent me a text yesterday. It's that kind of,
Okay.
it's so exciting. I love it.
Well, I'm blown away that people are, the general public are providing you with probably more than you can absorb. But how can fans out there get involved in 1421 Foundation's work? I mean, are there any study groups or research projects, traineeships, and the like?
No, I mean, I currently, it's a tough time, because I don't have a huge amount of support. It's myself. We have two other directors of the foundation, But it's because it's all volunteer led, you need people, or I need people to help me, really. I'd love, this is a passionate plea to anybody listening. If they are interested in learning more, and if they think they can contribute somehow, be it through their expertise, their time, or their money, I'm open to all help. I go and give talks around the world to try and spread the word. I love doing interviews such as this. It's been really fun. There are projects that people, we have a 1421 scholar that we've helped support throughout her career in China, at university in Hong Kong. We have I'm trying to build up a war chest so we can go and go after this Australian wreck. I've got a project in California. If anybody's in California, there's all sorts of stuff. There's some really cool stuff in California, like ancient stone anchors that were raised off the seabed in the 70s, and you can still go and see them in a museum there. Yeah, I'm just always looking for people who can help, people who've got the time and inclination, and we've got a really good selection of helpers, but I think I need to be a bit more systematic or a bit more kind of rigorous in creating new research groups or programs. We do want the three pillars of our foundation are research, education, and exploration. So the research bit we've done very well, I would say, and we've got 20 years of research. We had it all scanned. We've shared it with the University of Yunnan. We had a kind of a collaboration with the University of Yunnan. The research bit is underway. The education bit is how can we go to schools and teach the kids that actually, China did these wonderful things centuries, years before the Europeans. So there's the educational bit, and then the exploration bit, which is the stuff I find really cool, which is, let's go and get some funding together and go and survey a site in Australia that we think has a shipwreck on it. And how do we go about doing that? Who's going to finance that? So there are three kind of pillars that people can get involved with, or they can just, set up a phone call with me and talk through how they can help. I have a lady who got in touch last when I sent the last newsletter, who is a ceramicist, and she's been blown away by similarities between Chinese and New Mexico Native American artwork that she's found. She's like, wow, this is incredible. So she's creating a project, I think, that's going to explore the similarities of Chinese and Native American art. And yeah, there are lots of things going on. I just, I don't have the bandwidth to do it all myself, and I'd love help if anybody out there is listening and has some spare time and inclination to get involved.
Yeah, and exploration is expensive,
Yeah, unfortunately. The thing is, it's
that.
not nowadays. Like, I've been working with a team, some highly respected underwater robotics engineers who have developed a system now that instead of it where it used to be, you'd probably spend, I would say, probably £1 million or something to hire a vessel with a submarine and go and do all the stuff and do a proper survey. He's got guys who are building these little, they're called eco subs. They're tiny, the size of a almost a couple of tins of baked beans with all this amazing robotic equipment and data gathering equipment, and you can just drop it off the side of your speedboat. Let it run for 8 hours, and it'll pop up with a GPS later, and you go and pick it up. And that costs thousands. It's brilliant.
That's
It's game
amazing.
changing. Really game changing.
Miniaturization.
Yeah.
That's really unbelievable. Well, folks, I'm telling you really you I mean it not it's just it's a fun read anyway. I mean, it almost reads like a thriller. And so if you like Dan Brown and the Lost Symbol and the Da Vinci Code, you'll really like 1421 and 1434, but it's real science. I mean, it's like this is the real deal. So I really encourage people to read it and have the decency. Every time someone talks to me about Columbus, I say he didn't discover anything. He thought he was in China and he was in the
In the
Caribbean.
Bahamas.
Yeah. He didn't know what the hell he was doing. And then not to mention he massacred and his followers massacred millions and millions of people. But It's just it's fun. I encourage you to sign up to the newsletter. I have the email is info. I'll include that on our interview page,
Thank
and
you.
info at 1421foundation.org, I think it is.
Correct. Yeah.
You got the Facebook, you got the newsletter, you got the websites, you can buy the books.
Yeah, we've got two websites actually.
The
So,
two, yeah, with yeah, the
yeah.
get the original one, and
And
then the
also recently, just in case you have listeners in the UK, we've also earlier those last year now, we've been accepted as a registered UK charity. So we've set up a UK foundation, and this is
Okay.
to honour Gavin. It's called the Gavin Menzies Research Foundation. They wouldn't, the UK Charity Commission wouldn't let us use 1421 in the title because they said it was too controversial.
Oh my God,
So
are
we now
you
have a,
kidding?
as ridiculous,
Oh.
but we now have, yeah, fully legitimate UK charity that we're gonna, it's gonna be the kind of academic, any funds that we raise for it will be spent on laboratory analysis. We think just to really, I've always said, you know, I want to prove this theory, one way or the other. I'd like to prove Gavin correct, you know, and the way we
Yep.
do that is through laboratory analysis and scientific rigor. So yeah, that's another string to our bow.
You can tell how the establishment is scared shitless of 1421 and 1434 and Charlotte Harriet Reese and everything, because it completely negates the Western superiority and the Western, technology, and the Western, we're number one, we're the best,
Yeah.
we were the first, and so they're just they, it would just shatter, it would shatter Western civilization and
Yeah,
Western
for sure.
empire. If people started talking about what was the Chinese that discovered the New World, and I'll try to find it. There was actually a tweet on X that I saw during Columbus Day in the United States, which I think is
Columbus, October
October
the
fourth.
10th, I think,
They are,
October the 15th.
whatever, the second Monday or the
Yeah.
second Monday of October. And this guy just listed all, it wasn't just the Chinese. He listed all these Polynesians and these Micronesians and all these other civilizations that have, and you talk about, that would be another interview, but that the other civil, they have been crossing the oceans for millennia.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's not just the Chinese, it's just like it's been like a super highway for thousands of years. So well, anyway, Ian, this has been fun. Thank you very much for taking the time to regale us with all these amazing stories. And again, I really encourage people to read 1421 and 1434 if they have not already. And I'm going to get that other book, the one you talked about that you all did in 2013. I didn't know about that one, so I'll
Who
buy
Discovered
that.
America? It's called,
Yeah,
yeah.
Who Discovered America? And I'm sure. And I've got Charlotte Harriet Reese's book. I got her
Yeah.
DVD. Her DVD
Oh,
with the
nice.
map and everything. And it's really it's fascinating and it's true. I mean, it's
Yeah.
just you really have to be. It's just true. I mean, when you read it, it's true. I mean, it's true, even though you may not want to admit it, it's true. So, anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you
And
very much, Jeff. It's been a pleasure.
I will send you, I always transcribe my interviews, because I've learned years ago that some people listen, some people watch, and some people read, and they're like oil, water, and sand. They do not mix. And
Right.
so I send I trans I get it converted into transcript, and then I send it to an editor, and he cleans it up. But so it'll be probably maybe not this maybe in a week he'll get it
Brilliant.
done. And
Well, yeah, thank you, everyone.
send you the link, and maybe you all can share it and use it
Sure.
on your website.
For
All
sure.
right.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
I will give you a Buddhist bow
Oh, thank you.
and talk soon. Bye-bye.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.